Thank you for listening to Abstract Illusions Radio. With each breath of air, gain new insights and inspirations as we explore and expose the different aspects of the human experience. Now with your host, Jennifer Hellman. Good evening, everyone. This is Jennifer Hellman, and yes, we're live tonight. Tonight, I am really excited to talk to a woman that I was walking in the Tucson Festival of Books, and I looked over and I saw this sign saying 60, Sex, and Tango. And if that's not a great title for a book, it just stood out, and I said, oh, this is a woman I have to meet. Jo Moran is quite the lady. She is... She does a little bit of everything. She currently is a yoga teacher, but she also does a lot of tango. Her books and her blogs are very much an authentic voice of almost a lot of different generations all rolled into one, but she really is quite an amazing lady. As I spent a little time with her on... during the festival, and then we went out afterwards actually to go to tango, which was beautiful. So Joan, I thank you very much for being on the show.
You're very welcome. I'm pleased to be here with you, Jennifer.
Now it's 60, Sex, and Tango: Confessions of a Beatnik Boomer. Mm-hmm. But yet, say in your intro, you missed it by a couple years.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm 3 years too old. But I also said that I identify with the boomer generation. 3 years isn't very much. And so the zeitgeist of the boomers was pretty much my generation, because even though I was born during the war, I didn't identify with World War II. So I think what happened is that I had the advantage of also being a beatnik and grew up in San Francisco, and identified with the beat generation also. So I kind of cross over.
Like I said, there's many generations within your book and your energy. In the book, you say you identify with a 19-year-old, and I would say, yeah. You've got a very young spirit, and you're a wonderful dancer. You just have so much energy and confidence and just... You know your stuff, you study it well, and you present it. Now, I would like the audience to know a little bit more about your background towards this book. So, can you tell a little bit more about your background?
Right. Well, I've been a writer before. I started writing textbooks, actually, on acting, because my first discipline was theater. So I also ran a theater in which I did all the writing for the publicity, public relations, and for the programs. And during the years of my teaching college at UNLV, I wrote a couple of textbooks before I opened up a theater. So writing's always been in my soul. And then I did a work of fiction during the late 80s called Women Obsessed. And then I had a journey of about 15 years of being a screenwriter. So I've always been interested in writing in various forms. I think screenwriting was probably my favorite. The way I got to start this book is that I was woke up one day and I was 60. I think I turned 63 or 4. And I didn't really have any recognition or realization of what the decade of the 60s would be like. So I started to put down my thoughts in terms of all the surprises that I encountered. And that's the way the book got started. I didn't even know I was writing a book. I was just sort of writing about my thoughts about living in the 60s and what an interesting decade it actually was. My children were grown and adults. I was a grandmother. I was dating. I was on the internet dating. And I think really what spurred me on is my internet dating. I thought it was so funny. And I thought it was real. And I thought people might identify with that. But then I got into my adult children parenting me, crisis in the family, a death, and I thought, okay, I'm going to write a memoir. And that's kind of how it germinated.
So now, what do you want people to take away from this book?
Well, I think I'd love people to, first of all, follow their passions, because I think that brings a lot of happiness. Do what you think is fun and passionate for you in your life. And also to, because I'm a yoga teacher and I practice yoga, I feel that that particular practice brings me a lot of joy and a lot of contact with my soul and my and brings me self-knowledge, which then leads to growth and transformation. I think in the 60s, we got to keep on moving and keep on generating our energy in positive directions. Perhaps if we're tired, we give back. You know, if people aren't working, they give back. Or maybe if they've lost their jobs, they can be creative and do other things and think of other things to do with their lives, not just sit around and watch television. So I want to encourage people to face their surprises and recognize them and then transform. Grow, move in that direction.
So, with you have had a lot of variety of different disciplines. I mean, you went from different forms of writing and theater and yoga. Do you feel that it was like one step led to another, which step that led to this book and where you are now?
Oh, absolutely. I think that everything that I ever did in my life led me to that moment of writing the memoir, including being a single mother of two boys and kind of hoofing it on my own, changing disciplines, going from theater to film, and becoming a producer and a writer. And then it just kind of snowballed. And after it was all kind of done, some of these things were done, and I felt that I had kind of gone the distance and needed to move on, then I took up yoga, and that was a very strong path for me. And so I teach and practice and really love what I do and very passionate about it.
What? Okay, now, yoga has opened you up more for hearing your heart and your soul, and has there been anything that you've heard that has really surprised you? Because
in terms of...
Oh. It just seems like you're very, very much a together lady. So I can't. I mean, I can't.
Hello.
You seem very grounded and very present. So I'm just wondering if, along the way, you said there was a lot of surprises. Was there anything that you just really made you stand back and say, "Wow"?
I think it was the day I decided to become a yoga teacher and quit my day job and take a leap of faith. I think that was the big moment in my life when I took a leap of faith. And I did that at about 60 years old, 59, 60. That's really was the seminal moment for me when I kind of jumped off the cliff without a net under me. And decided to follow that. And I think that when you follow your passions and you go forward with what you believe in, you develop an awful lot of truth about yourself. You can see yourself much more clearly and make better decisions, better choices in your life. So, yeah, that was the big moment for me.
So was it you took a yoga class and you decided this is something that you really could go further with?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I was working in La Jolla, commuting from Los Angeles, and I was taking a teacher training on the weekends. But I had been practicing for probably 7-8 years when I started to take this teacher training course on the weekend. And, of course, I'd been studying with this master teacher for 5 years prior to that. And I had no idea why I was taking the class. It wasn't any. I didn't have a goal, except maybe to deepen my practice. Mm-hmm. And then the way the teacher training course was created by this wonderful a guru of mine, Max Strom, I after it was over, I said, "Oh my gosh, I want to teach." And that was a shock to me, because when we first got in the teacher training and Max went around the room and asked us all why we were there, I said jokingly, of course, I want to live forever. And it was because, you know, yoga brings a quality of your life and increases your immune system and, you know, gives you energy. So, you know, to me, yoga was a sort of a pathway to living a very long life. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that at the end, I really said, oh, I want to teach. And that was a surprise to me.
Was it a surprise to your guru, Max?
I think it was. And what Max so wisely did for me, because I wanted to assist him. I wanted mm-hmm. to take a couple of years and assist him in his new studio. And he took me out to lunch, and we sat there, and I said, Max, why can't I assist you? And he said, because, Joan, you have to go on your own path. And that was it. I went on mm-hmm. my own path. Yeah. I took it. I followed my path. And, you know, when you follow your path, things come your way. Because you do believe in yourself, and you believe in what you do. And even though I wasn't the most polished yoga teacher in town, I certainly was I had a unique style of teaching, which people liked or they didn't like. And that was how that evolved. And then I ended up going from the studio teaching to UCLA, where I teach now, and I have a private clientele.
And you are also, you know, when you take up a discipline, it's very much a discipline. I mean, even with your tango, you've been practicing and learning this for 17 years?
Pretty much, yeah. It'll be 17 years in June. Yeah, I studied a lot. I studied for probably 12 years with teachers in Buenos Aires and in Europe and in the United States. So, yeah, I really put a lot of study into what I do because I loved it. You know, it wasn't so, I wanted to do it the best that I could possibly do it in both disciplines. Yeah, and both of them are disciplines.
Well, I definitely think of both of them as very healing and very grounding and very much truly bringing up the best and the beauty and the grace in people.
Yeah, it's a beautiful aesthetic. Both of them are beautiful aesthetics. The lines, I think of tango as a meditation. And, of mm-hmm. course, yoga is a moving meditation when you do the flow yoga. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's a quiet and meditation, a yin meditation, where you don't move and you just focus in on your breathing, yourself, releasing your thoughts, not attaching to thinking. And that's a discipline, too. Probably the hardest.
Yes. The detachment of not... I mean, that's something that these days is a really good practice to really practice, is not attaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just heard recently where someone said it's really good to detach at least 10% of the time that you are in conversation with someone. Stand back, not literally, but, you know, mentally stand back and just keep about 10% of yourself out of the picture. And so you really get clarity about what's happening. You're very, in that respect, what that person was talking about is being very present.
Right.
Yeah, and being conscious. And that really does help you be a little bit more conscious when you are connecting with someone or maybe even driving a car, you know, kind of thing.
Yes.
So that you're very in the moment.
So let's get back to your book because it is broken up in different sections, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of curious why the different sections.
Well, you know, there's a formula in writing a book. My agent told me that it's best to have three sections, like eat, pray, love. You know, that's kind of like
right.
the benchmark of putting together a book. So we wanted to think of three things, and I am 60, and I'm talking about living in your 60s. And I do talk about sex and how it's very different. Sex is very different in your 60s and how the intimacy changes. So that's really important. And, of course, tango is really the meditation or the metaphor for working or creating your life and following your passions.
So... was there a section in the book that was easier to write than others, or did it just flow?
I have to say that the first section was the hardest to write. Being 60 was the hard, you know, finding, describing the surprises that I encountered. Getting one of my chapters is titled "Getting Rid of the Script," and going where angels fear to tread. In other words, just not doing the same thing that you always do. I use this "take a leap of faith" thing. Kind of, do you believe in magic? Is one section. One other section is don't drink the Kool-Aid. Don't follow the crowd. Talking about my children was difficult. The chapter 3 is called "Your Children Are Grown, Get Over It." So those are kind of difficult chapters to write about because they're very personal. They're very intimate. And I talk about going back to therapy. And I talk about becoming a grandmother in that first section. So all of them were pretty much revealing sort of like writing about my own therapy.
It's a very interesting, it's a great book. You're very, very candid. You're very, it's like having a conversation with you.
Well, I thank you, because that's the way I meant it. I meant it to have people read it feeling like they were having a conversation with me in a room. And people who do read it do have that response. And I'm happy about that, because that was pretty much my intent, to be candid and to be as honest as I possibly can. Another hard thing about writing the book was being my own truth detector. You know, I'd write something and then I'd read it and I'd say, is that really true? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can make this stuff up all day long, but really, is it the truth? So I had to go through every section and really ferret out that which was kind of like a half-truth, or maybe not even a truth at all.
Right, that artistic license.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how long did it take you to write this book?
Well, you know, you never really finish writing a book.
But, I know that one.
Yeah. The first time, I started in June, in the middle of June, with trepidation. And I think I've sort of finished it in October, but not really. You know, that was just the first draft.
Right.
And then I did my own editing on it. I found an agent. I put the book out to agents, and then someone picked it up. They sent it out. Nothing happened. So I took a few months for me to figure out what I wanted to do with it. I almost didn't even self-publish it. But then I realized so many people were self-publishing. It wasn't a big deal. And so I self-published it, and then I had an editor put on the book by my publisher. And that editor was superb. And so therefore, it took me another 6 months to edit the book.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a process that a lot of people don't realize, the process of writing a book. I've been writing myself for the last 10 years, and I've got like so many different drafts of different books, and it's like I get a new idea for a book, and it's just like, oh, I got to write this down while I got the inspiration for it. So I'm in the process of going through all my books and finalizing and getting things going with it, but it has been very, you know, informative for me in healing the process, and my guidance has always wanted me to enjoy the process, so they've uh-huh. prolonged it. Your book is it's fascinating. Just even some of the titles are I'm using an informative, and it really just, it catches your eyes, and they're almost like being in like a journal.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to be, well, first of all, I wanted the titles to be funny and catchy, and I really wanted that because I have a sense of humor in me.
Yes,
and,
you do.
I like to be kind of out there, and I think it's fun, somewhat provocative. So yeah, I kind of put the titles up, and I had fun, really a lot of fun with the titles. That was the most fun, and the easiest to do, I might add.
Sex with benefits, no expiration date needed.
Yeah.
Thongs I have worn.
Yeah.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? It's Forget Your Troubles, Come On, Get Happy.
Yeah.
It's fun stuff to open up, and I mean it's almost like one of those books that you could just open up and read a section, mm-hmm. and get a, you know, a really good insight in that moment. It really, I found it very informative, on a lot of different levels, and fun.
I hope it's fun. I mean, and I've had people come up to me over and over again to tell me how much fun and honest it was. But what the most surprising thing of all of this in the process of writing it, first of all, I didn't have a goal, so I just kept writing, didn't know what I was going to do with it. But the mm-hmm. second thing is the number of men who are interested in it. I thought I was writing it for a women's audience. I mean, I was convinced I was writing it for women. And when men started to buy the book and talk to me about it and want to talk to me about it, whether they were 25 years old or 40 years old or 50 or 60 or 70, I was always shocked and taken aback by why men would be interested. And, of course, they've all explained it to me. You know, they want to know what a woman's mind is like and how a woman works. And yes. one man who bought the book at the Tucson Festival came up to the – bought the book one day, came back the next and said, took me over into a corner and he said, "You know, I really don't know much about women. I thought I did, but when I read your book, it's like taking back the covers on a bed and looking under the covers and finding a woman." And I thought that was kind of sweet.
Yes.
He never knew how the brain of a woman worked, and he was fascinated.
Well, I get the feeling that most men don't, but they find it curious, intriguing, and yet they're not sure they want to go there.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well said, Jennifer.
Thank you. Well said. I've done a lot of observations, and it's been fun. Most of my friends actually have been men, and just as friends, and they're always kind of curious about me, but at the same time, keeping me at arm's length and just observing me.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been a teacher, and it's fun to teach men about women, and the different ways they think. And I think this book is a good illustration of the different ways a woman does think, because it's very insightful and honest. Is there a section in the book that you find yourself wanting to talk about more than the others?
I probably would like to, and this is probably fodder for my next book, which is going to be much more explicit on the boomer generation. So I hope to get that out of my system in the next book. And that is more on retirement and more on the benefits of a spiritual life. So it would be probably the second half of the book that I would like to extrapolate on and sort of talk about what the boomers do now after they've pretty much screwed up the planet. So I didn't get into that, and I kind of thought that it really wasn't for a memoir, but it was for some other kind of book.
So, can you talk a little bit more about what you're thinking your generation has done?
Well, you know, if we start to talk about the boomers and, you know, forget the 3 years difference.
Right.
You know, when we started off, I think the definition of a boomer is those born between 1946 and 1965. Or four, somewhere in there. I think I have it in the book. I can't remember. It's four or five.
Yeah, I think it's 64.
64,
I'm in 62, so I'm the tail end of it.
Yeah, you're the tail end. We came off of the war, and we came into a kind of in the 50s, an economy was just getting started. And we really bought into the American dream. And we were shocked in 1963 when Kennedy was shot, and it was a huge moment for our psyche. We kind of you know, it was what it would be like in for 2001 and the Twin Towers.
You know,
it was like we had that shock. Well, this was our generation's shock. Mm-hmm. And we were working hard. We were going to school. We were going to college. We were getting degrees. We were pretty serious. And shortly thereafter, we had a war. And shortly after that, in 1968, we had two more assassinations. Mm-hmm. So I think our psyche was pretty scarred. And I think then we began to protest, and then we began to make our voice heard. And we did a pretty good job of it, I think. And the war was our cause. And after that, it took us about 10 years to heal, I think. And then we entered in a very prosperous time in America where we all took advantage of being able to make a lot of money. And the 80s mantra of greed is good probably took us on a path that we were completely unconscious about what was going on. And giving back wasn't really in our minds. Saving, you know, getting in touch with nature, communing mm-hmm. with nature. And we let all that go. We let a lot of things go. We let social contact go. We let helping others go. You know, once we had a thriving Peace Corps, that it was very special to join and go around the world and help people. Well, a lot of these things fell off the map, and then we continued, and we ended up in this terrible moment in time where people overreached and mm-hmm. Accumulated masses amount of money for their own pleasure. So we didn't have a lot of connectivity in our lives after the 80s. So I think that's what happened.
And I think something else that happened during that era is no one really wanted to take responsibility.
No, they still don't.
And I was going to say, they still don't. And the youth today that has been born in the 80s and the early 90s is almost have this entitlement because that's what their parents kind of fed them, that mm-hmm. they're entitled. And now it's like, what, you want us to work and really earn something? Mm-hmm. What's that about?
Yeah, which kind of, it scars the next generation.
Right. Well, generally it goes seven generations in each direction.
Mm.
In some way or some form, it will take that long to really heal what's going on. So people born in the 40s, it's going to take, you know, 70 years.
That sounds about right.
to really clear things up. And mm-hmm. as somebody whose parents were actually born in the 30s and they were, you know, in the high school and they got married in the 50s and they were part of that generation of really building up America again and really believing in America. And now I see them now in their late 70s, they're 79, and they're just amazed and almost shocked at what America's been like.
I have statistics. I think I put them in the book, but certainly in the next book I'm going to highlight them more. It's about the boomers are the most depressed generation. Most of the boomers feel very pessimistic about the future. They're very shocked still and surprised at where they are and what's happened to their economic freedom and independence, and a lot of them are losing their jobs. I just had a friend of mine just get fired from a job. He's 66 years old. You know, he's got himself in a good position, but still, we lost a lot of our life savings in the recession.
Oh, yes.
Only, of course, having ourselves to blame for it because our eyes were closed, because we wanted to have our eyes closed because we didn't want to face what we were doing.
Right. And now it's the corporations don't want to take responsibility and they're part of it. And yet many of the corporations are still reaping benefits from it. Mm-hmm. So why should they take responsibility? It's a very interesting situation that's going on in the world today, especially in the U.S. It's going to be interesting how we kind of get ourselves out of this.
I think it's going to take decades. I don't know. That's why I'm sort of toying with this idea of the book, because there has to be a way to bring joy back into our lives and to see a future that is valuable and mm-hmm. joyful and creative, especially creative. We have to create life to live it well. And so that's a really important part of getting back in touch with our psyches and really taking a hard look at where we're headed.
Right. So in your generation in the 60s, and again, I've met a lot of people who are between like 55 to even 70, 72, and they're young spring chickens. I mean, they've got vitality and energy, and I'm amazed. I look at them and I said, there's no way you're that age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're among them. And it's just like, I'm just going, wow, I have a lot of energy, but at the same time, it's like, you really are a role model for the younger generations coming up to have that confidence, to have that presence, to really live your dreams. So I want to thank you right now for that, because you got me back into tango again, which I'd missed it, and it's just like, I put everything as an excuse not to do it, and I finally am back in dance, and I thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. That's terrific.
It's part of my soul. Dance has always been a part of my soul. So you brought back a little bit more creativity and joy in my life. So I truly thank you for that one.
You're welcome.
You know, sometimes it just takes that one person to just push you and say, yeah, it's okay. You can do it.
Yeah.
And people are needing more people like that, don't you think? There's role models that really say and give them permission. And that's the other thing in my business as a life coach. A lot of people are looking for permission.
Right. I think you're right. That's a good point, Jennifer. Yeah. They look for permission. And you don't have to have it.
You just need to give it to yourself.
Yeah, of course you do. And that's getting back to the yoga practice, which of course I highly recommend. But it's getting back in touch with yourself, and again, getting back in touch with yourself is a practice. If you've been out of practice finding your soul, then it's a practice to go back there and find it and spend some time in meditation, maybe doing some yoga, and. That's the only way you can do it. You can't, you know, it's not running a 10K that's going to get you in touch with your soul. You know, you've got to work at it. That's not the practice.
Yet I will say that running can be a meditation.
That is true. I have heard that.
I personally don't know it, but I do know a lot of people with a spiritual practice, and running is part of it.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of runners in my yoga class. They're marathon runners. And but they have their yoga practice too. I mean, they wouldn't even think about running a marathon without going to yoga twice a week. So that helps them. And I one of the marathon runners, we have a Los Angeles marathon on Sunday. He has his music in his ears, and he plays a yoga song throughout all of it. So he actually does meditate when he's running. But he does have a practice. So it's a little bit different.
Okay, You've mentioned yoga. Can you give people a definition of what yoga is?
Yeah, yoga is the practice of yoking or uniting your mind and body through the process of breathing. So a lot of people are walking around and their bodies and their minds are not connected. You can tell by people they're sort of not present. They're not there. So the practice, the yoga is yoking. The definition in Sanskrit, if you can give it a definition, it's not pure. It's yoking of the mind and body through breathing. The breath is called prana in yoga, mm-hmm. and prana means life force. So without your life force, then you are not living. So that is basically what it is. And people say, well, my mind and body are connected. I'm walking. I'm talking. Are you actually present? Is your mind, we call it the monkey mind. So the mind just keeps going and going and going and going. It never stops, and so you never have time to process. And the only way you can get back into a much more conscious level is by my feeling. I'm not the expert on this, but this is just my opinion, is through a yoga practice and a meditation practice. So that's basically what it is. It's the benefits are raising the level of consciousness. You're less reactive. You are able to make better choices. You know, all those good things. You're much more open to the heart. You have a generosity of spirit. And one of my major tenets in the book is what I talk about, forgiveness. So, you know, with an open heart, you can practice forgiveness. And without forgiveness, you'll never have joy in your life. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hi. We got dropped.
Yes, we had a little bit of a technical. So you were saying yoga, you do speak about forgiveness, and that is a huge, huge part of the energy overall that's going on right now is forgiving themselves and finding that self-love and loving and giving each other permission to be who we truly are.
So important. So important. It's not just forgiving others, it's forgiving yourself. You have to forgive yourself.
Mostly. And accept yourself.
Yeah. Well, in yoga, we practice the art of surrender.
Yes. Can you explain that?
Well, we are people, are humans, we are resistant. We're resistant in body and resistant in mind. And the postures that we practice are postures in which you completely give yourself up to that posture for, could be 3 or 4 breaths, 10 breaths, and it's a meditation. And in that meditation, you've surrendered everything to the breath. You can tell people who are resistant in class. You know, they don't want to bend forward and drop their head and their neck. They want to hold that. That's part of what they think is going to protect them. So basically, it's getting rid of the ego mind. I'm a very huge devotee of Eckhart Tolle and The Power of Now, and his second book, that talks about the ego mind. And we're just the human race is just about protecting ourselves all the time. It's very common. So the yoga practice helps us release and surrender and accept in the moment.
And it's a beautiful thing to do that.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Not easy.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I was reading a book by Eric Pearl called it, and it's about reconnection. And it's all about energy healing. And he has this amazing energy healing he does, but with his hands. He's a very powerful healer. But his guidance always says, you receive. Don't send. And it's really just opening yourself up to the divine and allowing yourself to transform and transmute the energy out without tainting with it. You just become that vessel to hold it. Mm-hmm. And we all have that ability to hold our own true identity of divinity within us. And yoga truly is one way to open that heart and truly find that person.
We talk about that kind of energy. I talk about energy balance all the time. And the balance comes through our chakras. Those are our energy centers. So we only deal with 7 chakras. There are many, many more chakras the yoga canon. But I think humans can handle 7. And it's very important that we balance these chakras. And so the practice is a practice of balance in mind and body. You can't go off. And the other thing I see, I just had a new student come in a couple times, and you can see the disconnect because the eyes are moving all over the place, and it's like his mind is going a mile a minute. He is so not there because his eyes are moving. And so what we do in yoga is we use something called a drishti, or a focal point. And I always say, quiet eyes, quiet mind. So if your eyes are quiet, your mind is quiet. And that takes some practice for all of us to do. We're still working on it.
So do you do additional meditation other than your yoga?
Yes.
And how long do you suggest to a student to do meditation?
You know, I can't prescribe that time limit, but I can say start with what you can start with. In other words, we are constantly allocating time during the day. So why not allocate time 5 minutes? You know, set a timer of 5 minutes. And if you feel that nothing happens in that 5 minutes, that's okay. It doesn't matter. Let's say you just thought for 5 minutes. You had the loop going on. The monkey mind was moving. It's okay. You've meditated for 5 minutes. You can't judge that. So you can meditate for 3 minutes. You could meditate for 5 minutes. It depends on the time allocation you want to give it. You could meditate for 20 minutes. You can get up in the morning 20 minutes earlier and meditate if that's what you want to do. But you need to sit up. Lying down it does not really count because you've got to have a straight spine and you've got to use the chakras. So if you're sitting in a cross-legged position on a cushion with your being very, very relaxed and just giving up to that time, whatever that time is, it doesn't matter.
And
five's not better than 20.
Right, you know? And it's amazing how much in the midday I will meditate, and it's amazing. I feel totally refreshed, even with 5 minutes of just quieting the mind and rejuvenating. It makes a huge difference to continue the day, and it doesn't take that much time. Mm-hmm. I do want to open up the phone line, so if anybody wants to call in, again, the number is 888. It's been so long, I have to look this up. This is horrible. It has been a while since I've done this live. I've been doing so many pre-records. But I do want people to call in and ask you the question. And one second, I'm just trying to find the number. Again, if you have any questions for Joan, we are live and you can open this up. I'm sure the phone lines are empty. And you can call in. And the number is 888-815-9756. If you want to call in and talk to Joan, again, that's 888-815-9756. If you got any questions about her book, Yoga, Tango, she is a wonderful person to know. Now, dreamwriting, and do you think that helped you with this book? Because this book is almost like a conversation, and it's very easy. Do you plan on making something more of your book?
Well, somebody picked it up and wanted to, thought it would make a great movie. But you, in Hollywood, that doesn't mean much. You know,
yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, sort of like, oh, I'm going to take it to my manager. And like, who do you see in the role? And we had a an hour conversation on this. And, you know, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you don't put any energy out in that direction. Let's put it that way. Because if you do, you're going to be waiting around a long time. So, you know, if somebody read it and got a handle on it in terms of how it could be filmed, yeah, of course, there's plenty of material there. But that wasn't my intention. So,
now, do you plan on having an audio version of this book?
Yeah, I do. I just have to figure out how to do it. I don't know how to do it. So, I would love to do an audio book.
We'll talk. I'll help you out with that one.
Help me out with that one, Jennifer. I haven't gotten there yet, but I do. I absolutely want to do an audiobook, and so many people have told me that I should do an audiobook, so I guess I have to do it, but I don't know how to do it yet.
Well, we will talk about this, because I do think it would be a very powerful book to hear your voice.
Thank you.
Reading this.
Nice of you.
So, you do yoga every day?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, maybe Sunday I don't. I teach classes. I teach a full schedule Monday through Thursday, and then on Friday I have spotty classes with private clients. I don't teach at UCLA on Friday because I try to, you know, make time for myself. Saturday there's always some private, and then Sunday I try just to rest my body because I have to be careful that I don't overuse it because it's already overused. But you know,
it's pretty healthy. You know, it's amazing. Anyway, we do have Chris on line one. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Hi, Jennifer. I wanted to know if there was a video out there for people who are pretty much homebound, and if yoga was good for people that are homebound.
Absolutely, Chris. Yeah. There are beginning introduction yoga tapes. You know, one of the best ways of doing it, if someone is homebound, is to go on Amazon and just put in yoga, and you'll see yoga videos, and you'll see a lot of them.
Okay, you, so you get don't have one of your own?
No, I don't. No, I never made a yoga video. No, that's one of the things I never did. But I tell you, they're out there. There are plenty of good ones. Very gentle yoga. You want to look for gentle yoga.
Gentle yoga.
Yeah, gentle yoga, and there's some really nice ones. Read the descriptions. See, and anybody who puts out these videos they're very good teachers. You know, they're not going to be teachers that aren't good. They're going to be good ones. They're names on these. You know, good names.
I also invited you to be my friend on Facebook. You'll see the invitation.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris.
And
that's one thing we did not mention is you are available on Facebook. There is a link on my page on BBS Radio. You can click on that, and it does go to your page.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have a blog. Did you want to talk about a blog?
I have a website, and I have a blog, and I Twitter sometimes.
Yeah, I was reading your blog. You said, "So you're 60, get over it."
Yeah, that's my blog. So you're 60, get over it. Right.
Over
oh, good. And my webpage is joanfrancismoran.com. It's my full name. And the Francis is with an E, not an I. And it's just www. And then if you go to my webpage, you can go to my blog.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's right there. There's a click on. So
being a beatnik, I can't imagine everything that you've seen that's changed in the past 40 years.
Yeah, lots.
Did you have any idea that it was going to be so science fiction in the now?
No, I didn't. Except that, you know, during the 80s, I got an idea things were going very, very badly. And by the time that the first recession came in 89, 90, 91, and I was caught in that housing recession, I guess that's when I really began to change my thoughts. I didn't quite think that, of course, one could never think about having the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center, happening. I could imagine the scenario of Wall Street, however. That wasn't too far out to think that things were going to collapse at some point.
Right. I was talking to Jennifer today, and something entered my thought process on all of the earthquakes and the tsunamis and the energy and everything. And, you know, I believe in positive energy and positive thought, and we've all been praying for a cleansing and a reorganization and just, you know, let's get it right. And then I thought, oh, my God, is this because that's what we've been praying for? Is this the reaction to what our petition is? Is this the universe cleansing?
I think so. I mean, that's a personal belief.
That's what Jennifer said, too.
Yeah, I have a personal belief that that's it. I think the energy is all wrong. And so, yeah, I think that's a result of it. Although natural disasters, of course, are not man-made.
No.
Nature's powerful, but I don't think we've respected nature very much.
Right, but isn't natural disaster still energy-made?
It's energy-made, but I don't think humans make it. I think that's part of the Earth's structure. I think it's based on science. But I think some of the other things that happen are, I mean, the nuclear reactor, you know? That's man-made.
That video on Facebook about that Japanese dog protecting the other dog?
That was amazing. His friend was hurt and the dog refused to leave.
It was a canine friend, by the way. It wasn't.
Yes, it wasn't, and it was just two canines that really had a strong loyalty. And I also saw on Facebook that they found an elderly woman.
Yeah,
I think Chris put that up, and a child that after all this time they found them.
Girl, yeah. And the picture on it, the rescuer smile, was just amazing to me. And so I've been trying to find good news stuff to post instead of all of the gloom and doomy stuff.
Yeah, it's not good to inundate yourself with that on a daily basis. You know, I mean, what we do in yoga is that, you know, I think this week I created an intention for every class that we do send light out to the Japanese people.
Absolutely.
And so we can do that collectively. I remember I was taking teacher training during 9/11, which was really horrifying. And the class was, of course, we were all unbelievably affected, and we were silent for a long time. And my teacher said the only thing that we can do, you can't, you know, jump out and fly to New York, but the only thing you can do is to be mindful about that situation and to send light and energy in that direction for healing. You know, you just still feel helpless, but you know, that's what you have. At least you're mindful about it, and you're aware.
I was just reading that yoga isn't the only zen-inducing kind of exercise. Researchers have found that people who do weight workouts is a great way to overcome your mood and anger management and stuff.
It sends adrenaline. It increases your adrenaline and what we call neurotransmitters. And those are if those aren't hitting around and you're not getting enough of the hormones flowing through your system, depression comes upon you. But so any kind of physical exercise is good for you, and it's good for the endocrine system, your adrenals.
Okay.
So that's very, very important.
That's for the weight workout?
Either that or a treadmill or, you know, an elliptical. Okay. Anything that does that.
I mean, even a walk can really...
A walk is great.
You know, especially if you're out in nature.
AM or PM walking?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
It's walking.
Doesn't matter.
No,
it's
not
just,
at all.
I mean, I usually take a walk, and it's usually a couple miles, but I just get in that zone, and I just very much connect to the nature, and I ground myself. That's my intention, is to ground myself and to center myself when I go for my walk. Mm-hmm. And it's a great workout. It really is. It's very much a meditation for me to walk. And believe it or not, Chris, you always do this. You finish out the show with me, which is awesome. No.
Thank you, Chris.
Chris is like my Ed McMahon. She's a great friend.
I start listening, and then I can't resist. I have to call in.
But I've
been actually out of town, out of state for a few weeks. I haven't been on the call for a while. And this was a really, really good hour.
Thanks for calling in, Chris.
Well, thank you for being a guest. I mean, I could probably carry this one on for an hour because I've got
questions. Well, thanks a lot.
But I'm going to hang up then, and I'll see you guys on Facebook.
Yes.
All right.
Okay, Chris. Thanks.
Ciao.
So Joan, why don't you give the places you are one more time, your website, your blog, Facebook, and so people know how to find you and your book.
Okay, so I'm on Facebook. It's just Joan Moran. Look me up. And I have a website, which is, and you can also get to my Facebook page from my website. The website has all the information. It's www.joanfrancismoran, it's all one word, .com. And that'll take you to my blog, which is, So You're 60, Get Over It. And the blog is long. It's called Confessions of a Beatnik Boomer, all one word, .blogspot.com. And you can read my blog there. And on Twitter at Joan F. Moran. F meaning Francis, the middle name. There are a lot of Joan Morans I discovered, so I started to use my middle name. And I'll be at the Los Angeles Book Festival the end of April. So if anybody's in the area, drop by.
Excellent. And you'll be out dancing as well?
Absolutely. Saturday night.
You got to do the tango. It's such a beautiful dance indeed. Yeah. So with that, Joan Moran, I thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet you in Tucson and hang out for you a bit. And obviously, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. And when you get that new book out, please get in touch with me. Because you are an amazing writer, human being, woman, and quite the role model for many generations.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for being on the show.
We'll be in touch. You have to tell me how to do an audiobook.
Yes, we will be in touch.
I'll email you.
Thanks,
okay.
Jen.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And with that, this is Jennifer Hellman saying, with each breath of air, we hope you gain new insights and information. Until next time, many blessings and good night.